getting to a very exciting point. Now, we are around 1946. Okay. Ali told us that the 10-year crusade of Shoghi Effendi, the echoes of it, the signs of it from Shoghi Effendi started coming up from around 1946. Many of you, probably even your parents, were not born at that time. But this is the period of our history that is very exciting for Ali and for me, and to a certain extent later on for Bahia, not in 46. It is the time that in Iran there is a lot of activities. As he was telling us, while the second 7-year plan was in process, many national assemblies had their own plans. Iran also had the plan of the 45 months, and it was a lot of excitement in the country. In 1950, when the British Isles, the Baha'is of the British Isles, so successfully they completed their 6-year plan, and Shoghi Effendi applauded them to the Baha'i world, and they were so excited, and everybody was so happy for them. At that point, Shoghi Effendi, it is before the end of the 7-year plan, remember? Shoghi Effendi told the National Assembly of the British Isles that now there is a period of 2 years, and you are responsible to open parts of Africa. And there were 4 other national assemblies to come in and cooperate and help in this plan. It is known as the 2-year African plan. Now, Iran was one of the national assemblies that was supposed to cooperate. It's going to become a little bit personal, this part, because I'm talking about people that I personally knew who participated in this plan. The first one who arose and offered to pioneer to East Africa was a little woman, German origin. Her name was Claire Gong. She was living in England. She had gone to England in early 1930s, I suppose, like all young people, to learn the language. She stayed there, and she was caught up during the war. She could not go. She did not want to go back to Germany. She was a very fine woman. She had, by then, by the time the war started, she had become a Baha'i. And she was terribly upset and kind of ashamed of what was happening in Europe. And she was a very simple person. She did not have any special profession or education, so she did many odd jobs in England. She was for many years nanny in the homes of families. She did a lot of seamstressing, you know, tailoring, but she would go into the homes of people and do it. And so this Claire was the first person who offered to go and responded to this call of the 2-year plan. She started by boat from British Isles for East Africa. Now, in the meantime, somebody else from Iran also offered to go. And because he flew by plane, he arrived in East Africa before Claire. But the person who really first answered the call of Shoghi Effendi was Claire Gong. So Jalal Nakhchivani, Ali's brother, who was the man from Iran, arrived in Tanzania, in those days known as Tanganyika, first. And very soon after that, Claire also arrived in Tanzania. They were three countries in Africa that Shoghi Effendi wanted to open to the faith. Two were in East Africa, Tanganyika and Uganda, and one in West Africa, Liberia. Two American people went to Liberia, Bill Foster and Valerie Wilson. And now Tanzania was open, Tanganyika was opened by Claire and Jalal. Our family came in at this point. I have to tell you a little bit because really the force behind Ali and my pioneering were my parents. It was my father and my mother who first wanted to go, arose and said they wanted to go. My father was a very interesting man. He was, in one way, a very unassuming, very quiet in some ways, not in every way. And his participation in Baha'i activities were very limited. As long as I remember, he was the member of the committee who acquired the Baha'i holy places. They bought these places and took after them. I think that was the only committee he was on. He was a businessman, a very successful businessman, very much involved. But he had one point in him that was, for us, his children, was always very outstanding, and people who knew him knew as his strongest point, and that was his tremendous love for Shoghi Effendi. Many, many times he did many services from the point of his material means to the faith, but always very quietly. He hated the idea of standing up and offering, you know, contribution. I don't remember ever in my life seeing my father doing that. Whenever he gave anything, we heard usually, many years maybe later, from outside, that it was he who had done it. He was very quiet in that way, but he was always ready that whenever there was a need, he would arise. My mother was quite the opposite. She was very full of fire, and she wanted always to serve, and she wanted, and her home was always open for the purpose of serving the cause. And for years, ever since we children were small, we would hear my mother's asking my father that, why can't we do something for the faith? Whenever there was any plan anywhere, she was the one who would cry and say, why can't we go here? Why can't we go there? Why can't we pioneer? My father was solidly sitting in his home. He was well into his 60s. He had retired. He has built himself what my mother referred to as Marble Palace in the north of Tehran, everything for the comfort of the end of his life. In this house he has built, he had specially had a very huge, it was a big house, and he had a roof kind of garden. And I remember he referred to it, the reason he did it, was his sons are going to finish their education, they come back home, he would like to have their weddings up on that roof. This was the plan of the end of his life. At this point, one of his friends came to visit him, and he brought with him the cable of Shoghi Effendi, asking the Baha'is in Iran to participate in this African campaign. And so this friend looked at my father and he said, how about it, Mr. Banani? And of course my mother was just all waiting, you know. And that night My father told my mother, how about it? Why don't we go? From that moment until they left, I think it was the matter of 2 or 3 months. I don't know, Ali and I were living in Shiraz. They closed their home, they packed their things, they got all ready. And before they decided to go, of course, my father wanted to know how he can go. He could not speak any language in Africa, and he felt that he was too old, he needed the help. And he sent a cable to us, or a message to us. Or maybe it was when Ali had come to Tehran to attend the National Assembly, he spoke with him and asked him that, if we go, would you agree to come with us so that we won't go alone? Now we had another kind of life ourselves in Shiraz. We had gone to Shiraz because another wonderful Baha'i, Mr. Samandari, it's a long story, he was asked by Shoghi Effendi to be in Shiraz, especially for the protection of the faith. There was a lot of covenant breakings and a lot of trouble. And Mr. Samandari had written to Shoghi Effendi and asked, because there are a large number of youths in Shiraz, I need the help of a young person. And he suggested that if Shoghi Effendi approved, he wanted Ali to come to Shiraz to help him with educating the youth in what he's doing here, the World Order of Baha'u'llah. So we had gone to Shiraz with the blessing of the beloved guardian, and we were quite sure that that's where he wanted us to be. Now my father asked us if we agreed to go with him. Ali was quite sure in his heart, and he assured me that, you know, we are here because Shoghi Effendi wants us to be in Shiraz. He's never going to agree, you know, that I should leave Mr. Samandari at this time. So to satisfy my father, he said, yes, but you see, it's a good thing to ask if you put my name, also put the name of your son, Amin, so that Shoghi Effendi would choose one. And he was sure that it would be my brother, Amin, who would be chosen to go to Africa with him. So we sat quite comfortably in Shiraz when suddenly we received a cable from my father quoting the beloved guardian that it was meritorious and that he approved of our going, that yes, go to Africa. So suddenly our life became completely upside down. My father and mother and my little brother, who was only 9 years old, left Iran early months of 1951. I followed 2 months later, and Ali had to close down his business and his work and everything. So it took us altogether about 6 months before we could leave for East Africa. In the meantime, my parents and myself were in London, and we waited for Ali to come to consult with National Assembly and set off for East Africa. I remember when we were leaving Tehran, our friends, our very close friends, were giving farewell parties. And in these parties, there was a kind of mixture of joy and sorrow. Nobody until that time had really gone to Africa, to the depths of Africa. Nobody knew where we were going, what's going to happen to us. And I remember half joke, half serious, our friends would look, well, say, all right, goodbye. God knows who will eat you, where, you know, you're going to Africa. This was the attitude. People did not know really much about Africa and life in Africa. So we were, when we left England for East Africa, we were a party. I have a picture here. I wanted so much to have it. Somebody, just a friend, had sent it to us. I leave it here. Afterwards you can look. We were a party of, in our family, we were five. It was my father and my mother, Ali and myself, and Bahia was 3 years old. And there was a young man, English young man, Philip Hainsworth, who also was going to Africa with us. He was a very wonderful man. And all the years that we were in Africa, we worked together and we lived in Uganda together. And he was really like a member of our own family and very close friends. We left England and the first stop was in Rome. We had two nights in Rome, and Dr. Giacchieri and his wife were living in the Baha'i Center in Rome. They invited us, and Dr. Giacchieri was really so loving and just showered his love on us. And he gave us a camera that when we go to Africa, we take pictures and send to Shoghi Effendi. Our friend Philip was young and very energetic, took the camera to make sure everything was in order. We never saw it again because he had opened it up. He couldn't put it back together, so no picture out of that camera. And so we set off. It was a very interesting trip. We left Europe, we left Rome, and our next stop was in Cairo. Now, arriving in Cairo coincided with all the big upheavals in Iran. It was the time that Dr. Mossadegh kicks the British out of the oil company. All the British aeroplanes were there to evacuate the British subjects from Iran. So the poor British government not only lost the oil in Iran, but had put up 5 nights in first-class hotel in Cairo, waiting for a plane to come and take us to East Africa. It was a very interesting thing. But our trip with Philip from the very beginning was quite fascinating. Philip considered us, you know, coming out of Iran, and he was up to a point he was right. Coming from Iran, we don't know the ways of the English, so he should be our mentor and tell us everything that we should do right during this trip. The first thing when we got on the plane, he looked across. I never forget, his eyes was always on Bahia's tray. She was a little girl, and he knew that she cannot eat everything. So she would always look at that and say, if she doesn't eat, pass it on to me. I remember first day on the plane we were flying, she looked at the air hostess. She said, you know, this family, these people come from Iran. And the main meal for Iranians is bread. They like a lot of bread. Please bring more bread. And then when she went to bring bread, she looked at us and said, listen, don't say you don't want it. Take bread. Give it to me. I had never seen. For us, appetite of Philip became quite something. He was always hungry. I remember he found out in the hotel that we did not like the very heavy English breakfast. So the first morning he came a little bit late to the breakfast room, and he found that we had not accepted the egg and bacon. Boy, he was so upset. He said, if you don't want it, order it. I'll eat it. Would you believe it that every single day Philip would have 10 eggs and bacon? All our eggs and bacon would go to us. So our experiences began very early with Philip. We arrived in, our first stop was in Tanzania, in Dar es Salaam. By then, Ali's brother and his family had settled there, and Claire Gong was working in a boarding school as a house mother. She was not in the city, she was out in the school. And there was one Indian pioneer there also. I don't know what happened to him. In halfway through, we lost him. He just disappeared. But that was all. There was nobody else. We stayed in Tanzania for a month, and we came to the decision with the consultation with National Assembly of British Isles that because Tanzania already now had pioneers, we would go to Uganda. Now, Kenya was not part of this plan because there was already one Baha'i in Kenya. There was an English woman, a young woman, who previously, before she had come out of England, she was a member of National Assembly, very wonderful, wonderful young woman. And she had married and come, and she lived in a tea plantation somewhere outside the city. So Kenya was open. There was a Baha'i there. We left Tanzania, Dar es Salaam, and we came to Kenya, and we drove from the port of Kenya all the way up to Uganda. We did not know. We were five of us on the car, five grown-ups, and we relied a lot on Philip because we were going to a British territory, but even Philip had never been to East Africa. He had no idea where Uganda was, what kind of a country was. And for some reason, I don't know why many of us women have this habit. For some reason, we always think our husbands know more than we do. Often they do more, know more, but for some reason, I thought that Ali knows everything. Why? I don't know. He had never been to Uganda either, but I would ask all kinds of questions, you know. For example, we stopped in a little town called Jinja, which is about 50 miles from Kampala. It was nothing. It's the source of the Nile. And in those years, in 1951, it was really just a large village. There were few English families because they had made the dam there. And so there were some Europeans living there. But otherwise, a tiny little town, a village, a big village. And we knew, Ali had told us that this is the second largest town, city in Uganda. And my heart fell. I said, where are we going? I said, Ali, do you know how big Kampala is? Why do I ask him? I don't know. But I asked the question, and Ali very confidently told me, said, well, I think it's about the same size. I tell you, the whole 50 miles from Jinja to Kampala, I was horrified. I thought, where am I going? I'm taking my child to this place. Is there any schools there? Is there any facilities I can put this child to school or... So the car comes. I don't know if any of you have ever been to Uganda. If you haven't, I suggest one day for holiday go there. It's a beautiful country, and Kampala is a very beautiful town. The car goes up the hill, and you suddenly look down in this little jewel of a town. In 1951, it was a tiny little town, but a jewel of a little town. It's just hills and hills and hills, very much like Rome, seven hills, all beautiful and green and luscious greenery. It is in the middle of a rainforest. It's a very beautiful town with the lake and everything. So just coming up and looking down at this town forever, I think I'll take that sight with me to the next world. The beauty of it, the joy that it created in our hearts, that what a lovely place we have come to live. We arrived in this town of Kampala, and Africa of 1951 was a very different Africa of today. It was a colonial Africa. It was an Africa with divided lines. It was a line for the Europeans, and the line was thick and high, and a line for the Asians, all the poor Indians that 25, 30 years before us had been taken there as laborers to build the railways and so on, very ordinary working class people. And then there was the line for the poor Africans. They were even not considered anything. We arrived in a society like that. We had come out of a background that we had a lot of other problems, but there was no racial discrimination ever. We had never sensed anything like that. So it was not an easy place to adjust. We arrived and the only place we could go was, we lived in a hotel. And it took us 3 months before we had enough possibility of residency there to get a house. And it was very hard to get houses because most of the houses were government houses for people who were working, civil servants. And then you just had to look and look and look to find a place. It was very interesting. The friends that we made from the very beginning. One of them was the very head of the immigration office. He was the head immigration officer, an Englishman, who had lived in Uganda for over 20 years. Very soon after we arrived, he was retired and left the country. And from him and his wife, we learned many things of how to adapt ourselves. He was the one that when we applied for residency, he placed us in this section which is known as European. I don't know why. I think one reason why they had never seen Persians and just didn't know what to do with us. They knew that, you know, we were not Indian to put us with the Asian group. We were not Africans to put us there. And so you looked at us and just decided, all right, we will put them in this group of European. At that time, we did not know that when you are placed in a place, you are going to stay in that place. You have your limitations, and there you have to adjust yourself. However, we stayed 3 months in a hotel, and eventually we found a house, and we moved into it. And now during these 3 months when we had no home and we had nothing and we didn't know how to start, you won't believe it, once again, we have come, all three of us, we have ended up in another place very much like that. We live in a little town called Molsheim. There are no other Baha'is, and we don't know how to start the community, building up a community. In what we did in Africa was wonderful. We decided that as we don't know anybody, as there is no one to introduce, and then Philippines was very soon after that found a job as a civil servant with the government, and they posted him in another little town, that Jinja. So it was just our family. And we were dying to see what to do. Thank God Ali is a football fan. So he started going to every game of football just to watch. And that was the place we started to meet people and make friends. But we were in a hotel. This was a European hotel, and under no circumstances you could invite Africans to come and sit and have a cup of tea with you. This was unheard of. And it was the period which we were trying to get our residency and settling down. We couldn't do anything to break the laws of the society. So, through the introduction of one man and then another man, all from the football game, we found one African who offered his home. He said, all right, if you want to meet people, you can come to my home. And so we would drive, you know, once a week to the home of this man, and then his neighbors would come there. And this is the way we started to meet people and to mention the face to people until we had our own home. It took from we arrived in Uganda in August of 1951, and for 6 months nothing happened. Then we had one Baha'i and a second Baha'i and the third one who was not all there. He was coming and going, and we were hoping. We made many friends, but to become Baha'is, not very easy. So 1952 arrived, and in the February of 1952, my parents were going on pilgrimage. Now, by then, we had wonderful firesides. Every time that we had meetings and fireside, the house would be packed full of Africans, but nobody wanted to be Baha'i. Many of them would come over and over. Amongst them was also a young man who was coming many, many times. So as our parents were going to Haifa, we asked them for, we request Shoghi Effendi through them for prayers. Because we had these meetings every Sunday, we asked the beloved guardian that if on next, the following Sunday, when my parents are in Haifa, if when he goes to the shrine of the Baal, that he would say a prayer for our gatherings here, maybe something would happen. So that Sunday came, and we all had our meeting, and very excited and very full of expectancy. The house, I remember, was packed full. There were questions and answers, and Philip had come all the way from Jinja that day to, because this was special, Shoghi Effendi was going to pray for us. They had questions, answers, tea and cake, and it got dark, and everybody got up and said goodbye, and they went home. I remember that flatness that we felt. We all sat down and said, what happened? Did Shoghi Effendi pray? What happened today? And in this feeling of really kind of depression, suddenly there was a knock at the door. We opened the door, and this young man that we had seen him had come at different meetings, never asked the question. He always sat in the back. Nobody really had really noticed him. He was standing there. He said, excuse me, I had a question, but there were too many people. So everybody said, come in, come in. He came in and said, I had a question. May I ask? He said, yes, please. He said, how does one become a Baha'i? Well, you can imagine. You can imagine Ali is easily hugging and kissing everybody. That hug and kiss was something very special. And this young man was Enoch Olinga. He was the fruit of that prayer of the beloved guardian that day. I want to tell you a little bit about Enoch. I'm not going to tell you his whole story. I'll just tell the beginning of the story. Because I'll tell you the rest of his story when we get to the time when he went and became the Knight of Baha'u'llah. But this is now long before that. He became a Baha'i that day, and we had never seen anybody like him devour the writings the way he did. He just couldn't read and take enough from us. We had a very small kind of library of the essential Baha'i books in it, and he borrowed book after book and book after book. He arranged with Ali. He wanted to know more. He was working for the government. He had a small job. He had to go early in the morning and work very late. So the only way that he could study the face was every morning. Ali would go early in the morning, 6 o'clock, to Enoch's home. They would have an hour of study together. And then Ali would take him. This was the time that he usually would have to wait for a bus to go to his work. Ali would study with him for 1 hour and then take him to his office. This was the only time he had that they could study together. This man, I can't say that he was one of those instantaneous changes. No. It took him time to study and learn. But the fastness of the growth, spiritual growth of Enoch Olinga was phenomenal for us. Before he became a Baha'i, he was an educated, for that period, he was an educated young man. He came from a village. He was not from the city. He came from the north, from a village in the north of Uganda. He came from a family. His father had become Christian. So he was really the second generation Christian. And he had gone to primary school and secondary school. This was his education. He had a little bit more knowledge of the world because during the war, he was part of the what they called East African Rifle, which was part of British Army. And the British Army had taken him as far as India and Burma, I think, not very far. And that was it. So he had seen a little bit outside of his own country, but not more. He worked for the government and he was a translator in this government office. But in the army, he has picked up the terrible habit of drinking, and he had been a heavy, heavy drinker. And for many, many months, he had been warned by his employer, the man who was in the office above him. And he had become a heavy drinker, so much so that often he missed his office. And so by the time this poor man became a Baha'i, they had built for him quite a dossier. And now he became a Baha'i, and instantly he stopped drinking. He had really organized his life differently. He had his children, and I remember one of the first things Enoch had in his home was very soon, a couple of weeks after he had become a Baha'i, his third child was born. And he came very anxiously to our house, and he said, What is it? We do as Baha'is when a child is. I know we don't baptize them, but what do we do? So he was told that as Baha'is, we will have a gathering of the family or the friends. We have prayers for the child, and the parents have chosen the name. They will announce it, and it's a kind of festivity combined with prayers. And this was the first thing Enoch had in his home. He had a little gathering, and he had arranged for refreshments and everything, and named her his third child, Florence. He had the two before that. So Enoch was just wonderful. About 3 months after he became a Baha'i, he lost his job because this file against him had already been gone through the higher, echelons. It was signed by the head of the government office. It was nothing they could do. And no matter how he pleaded that I don't drink anymore, I have changed, he lost. He came to our house very upset. He just had his third child. He had his family to take care. And I remember he came and he was very upset that what I do now with this dossier, I will not be able to find another job. And I remember my father, in his own simplicity, took him in his arm and he said, Enoch, don't worry. I am sure Baha'u'llah has something better for you in store. Don't worry. Just wait and see what happens. And it really, that's exactly what happened. Very soon he found another job. Now, at this time, the Baha'i community of Kampala had become enough numbers to have our first local assembly in Kampala. This was in Rezvan of 1952. Now, Uganda has one local assembly. At this time, another pioneer couple arrived, which I love to talk about them to you because they were some very special human beings. Rex and Mary Collison. They were American. They came from United States of America. They came from California. He was a retired professor. And They were wonderful old Baha'is. They had heard of the faith during the trip of Abdu'l-Bahá, and they had become Baha'is very soon after that. The story of how they became a Baha'i was very legendary in the United States. It was very unusual and unique. He was a professor in university, in Cornell University, and there was a Baha'i who was a salesman. He used to go all over the world, or the United States, and he combined his job as a salesman with teaching the faith. Before he went to a town, he would send word, for example, to a university. He said that I am a salesman, I have such and such books I'm bringing there, and I have a very new message to give people. If you give me time, I will come and give a lecture. And often they would give him time. So he went to this University of Cornell, and he gave a lecture on the Baha'i faith, he and his wife. They were all professors as his audience. And they all listened. And then one of them asked, "Is there any book you can give us?" This man was Colby Ives. You must have heard his name. He was a very wonderful Baha'i and he's written books. Mr. Ives looked at his wife and they just couldn't talk with each other much, but somehow that look, they agreed. He said, "You know, we are just coming from Wilmette. There is a brand new book out of print, had just come out, and we have bought a copy of it. We have not had time yet to read it, but we have this one copy with us. We will leave that with you." This was Baha'u'llah and New Era. First of all, imagine, I would never have parted with that book myself. I don't know. I don't think I would, but they did. They left this book with a group of people who had been in the audience. And they promised that now it's the beginning of autumn, as soon as roads are open, we will come back again. And they left. 6 months of the winter of New York State, you know, is quite something. It's much more snow than this. And they were not able to come back. But for during these 6 months, a group of 9 professors and their wives, every week they got together. They read part of this book. Every one of them had a notebook. They put down their questions, waiting for the day that this man will come again and answer their questions. 6 months later, when Colby Ives and his wife arrived again in Cornell, they stayed 3 nights with this group of people. Every night, these people were all working during the day. They would have their dinner. After dinner, they'd get together. And sometimes till 3 a.m, they just bombard this poor man with their questions. Questions after questions. On the 3rd night, all of them, 9 of them in as one whole, they became Baha'is. It created such a noise in United States. Nobody had heard of anything like this. Not only that 9 people at once became Baha'is, but people of that caliber, all of them are very highly educated, they are academics. It was unheard of. I remember Mary said that when we became a Baha'i, of course, then Colby Ives told them, "Now you have to form your local assembly. Rizwan is coming and you are forming your local assembly." So out of nothing, suddenly came a local assembly. And Mary said Baha'is from all over the United States sent them cables and letters of congratulations. And she used to say, "You know, we were really quite insulted. We said, what's the matter with these Baha'is? They don't know what good thing they have? Why are they so excited?" She said, "We found out when we went and opened a new place and tried to form a local assembly, then we knew what it meant. to suddenly have a local assembly. So these two came from such a background. For many, many years, Rex Collison was the chairman of the National Teaching Committee in the United States. Very deep and confirmed Baha'is. It was really wonderful to have somebody like that in the community. And both of them were on fire with teaching the faith. They started teaching the faith in schools. Because he was a retired professor, it was a very good opening for him. They would go to these schools. Usually there was private school, because if it was a mission school, they wouldn't let them cross the entrance door. But to private schools, they'd go and offer to give lectures on Baha'i faith. Within the first 6 months they were in Uganda, many students came into the faith, from amongst them some really outstanding Baha'is. They were so wonderful. I'll tell you something, if just to show you their caliber. I remember one night we were all together. I looked at these two darling people and I said, "Oh, what a wonderful thing you have done. This is your age is the time to come on pioneering. You have lived, you have finished with your life. You have done all your hard work of earning, and your children have grown up and married, and you are free. Now you have come, and without worrying over where you are going to put your child to school or where you get a job, you know, to live, this is all behind you. It's the best time you have come." I thought I was very clever with this thought. And I remember both of them looked at me as if I was a creature from another planet. They said, "What are you talking?" They said, "You know, since we have come, and we have every night when we have our reading and our prayers, you know how sad we are that we have left. We have come so late to serve Baha'u'llah. Why didn't we give him our prime of our youth? We look at you and we envy you. You are giving Baha'u'llah the best years of your lives. And we waited. Now at our age, we are old, we are tired. Is this the time to give to Baha'u'llah?" I had never thought in that way. And it was one of the greatest lessons in my life that I received from these two precious souls. They did so much. Mary Collison became really the closest friend in my life. And I remember one day I looked at her, I said, "You know, Mary, I love you so much. You are the closest friend. But you know, you are 2 years older than my grandmother." She was horrified. So was I. But, It doesn't matter. Age doesn't come in. When you come across in life with people like that, it is an honor, it's a privilege to see them and to know them and to become friend and to learn from them so much. They were very deep Baha'is, and Mary was a woman full of ideas, full of initiatives. She started in Uganda some years later something that was such a joy. I very many times traveled with them. She wanted to train women. And how would she do it? We had training course in those days in Uganda, in Africa. Today is very different. Now that we go to Africa, we are so proud of the African women because they are in the forefront. Many places, they are one of the most active members of the community are women, but not 50 years ago. In those days, women wouldn't come forward. They were shy. They would not ask questions. Often, they would not become Baha'is. And if they did, you never saw them. So Mary decided it's time to have a special course, training course for women. So our first training course was in the village because we knew we couldn't bring them to the town. And Mary worked for this training course for weeks because she was determined that what she wanted to teach these women wasn't only the Baha'i teachings, but she wanted also to teach them hygiene. She wanted to teach them child care. She wanted, because of some child mortality was so high, she wanted to teach them, you know, overall things that they should know. In Uganda, amongst this particular tribe, there were many taboos. Everything good was taboo for women. You went to the village, the chicken was taboo for women, the egg was taboo for women. These were all good for men, but women shouldn't eat it, because all kinds of reasons. So Mary wanted to very gently to break the taboo without making too much noise. So she told them that she prepared, she said she's going to teach them some cooking with the products that they can grow themselves. Because otherwise everything they had to buy in the shops. In those days, you know, white bread and white sugar, these were all new things in Africa. And although they were wonderful sugar factories, and we always went and bought, for example, molasses and brown sugar from the factories, but the Africans in the villages would pay 10 times more to buy the white sugar because the white sugar looked better. The white sugar was what the Europeans were eating, so it must have been better. So Mary wanted to teach them that this wasn't good. And she had prepared to cook special things and prepare. And I remember in one of her lessons, she stood up and she was telling them that what harm the white sugar and this awful white bread in the shop is going to do to them. And as she got excited, everybody was just quiet. There was no reaction to Mary. Mary wanted, was just very much like Bahia. She was just full of it, and she wanted to bring about a reaction. So she said, "Do you know what is going to happen to you if you eat this white sugar all the time and the white bread? Do you know what will happen to the next generation?" No reaction. In her excitement, she took her denture out. She said, "This is what will happen to you." Now these poor women in the village, they had never seen a denture. You know, Africans have beautiful teeth. So they saw this, the whole place burst into laughter. It was the funniest thing. Nobody had told them about the Europeans. The next thing I noticed, all the eyes were on me. "Come on, you take it out." Hard time to convince them that mine wouldn't come out. But she did wonderful work. She would go to the shops, the Indian shops, and they had pieces of sample material. And she would talk to them about her gatherings of the ladies, you know, women in the villages. And they would give these things free to Mary. She would bring them home, and she would get the women around to come, and she would teach them how to sew. Put these different pieces together, and she would cut for them children's clothes. She did so many small, you know, work, taught so many beautiful things to the African women that now we make a lot of fuss with our NGO work. I think she started the first NGO, really, in East Africa, in Uganda. Bless them, they were really a couple, wonderful, because Rex also, who was a professor of agriculture and a very learned man, he left his mark forever in Kampala. When the temple was built, he was the one who made the gardens, he was the what they call them, the landscape architecture of the temple grounds were all done by Mary and Rex Collison. They were the first caretakers of the Baha'i temple. Not only they worked and watched over the building of the temple, but that they watched over the program of the temple, the arrangement of everything. They did wonderful, wonderful service in Uganda. And the crown of their period of pioneering really was that in 1953, they volunteered to go and open one of the Virgin Territories, and they both became Knights of Baha'u'llah. And of course, they were not able to remain there because they were kicked out, and so they came back to Uganda. But they did a wonderful, wonderful service in Africa. Am I taking too much? What is the time? No? No, it's 6 o'clock. Yeah. All right, it's enough. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. If you want to see Bahie here, 3 years old, so I keep here, and you have to pay for that. So to increase our fund. Thank you. Now you have lucky you. Your study time, and then this evening is the last evening of artistic workshop. Last announcement. Please, when you go to your room for have your rest to sleep finally, please keep more silence in the corridors. Thank you so much.